Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Osiris.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to Inside the Musician's Brain. This is our last episode in Season 4, Episode 40. We're closing out with a bang. I have an amazing guest today. I need you all to get ready to get heady with the one and only Daniel Donato. This conversation was rich, super interesting. This dude is a deep thinker, wise beyond his years, and of course a phenomenal musician. He's got an awesome new record called Reflector that's on the way, coming out in early November. So stick around to learn so much more about Daniel, about the album, about everything that he's got going on. Inside the Musician's Brain is brought to you this season by Deering Banjos. I want to say a huge thank you to Deering for sponsoring the pod this year and also for just being a generally awesome, badass company. Great people. They sure do contribute a lot to our musical community and to the world in general. And I got to say that means a lot. I can't say enough great things about everyone over there at Deering. And yes, they make phenomenal banjos. They make an amazing affordable banjo. They make great finger picks. Everything is really high quality, but that's only part of the reason why they are a great company. You got to check out Deering for all your banjo needs. And a huge thanks to them for sponsoring this season of Inside the Musician's Brain. We are also brought to you today by Jono Pandolfi Designs. That's my older brother, Jono, mentioned here on the podcast quite often, especially in episode 38 with Mike Gordon. You get some good Jono Pandolfi context. He's always been a huge inspiration to me. I really mean that. And he continues to be with what he's created at his incredible dinnerware company. Check out jonopandolfi.com, JonoPandolfi.com, to style out your kitchen, your home, with the most beautiful handmade ceramics. This stuff is absolutely incredible. It's in some of the most amazing restaurants all over the world. And personally, I just love to be inspired by it daily here at home. I love having it around. And I should say, I have a few custom Jono Pandolfi Designs ITMB ceramic dishes. We got ITMB merch going on right now. Hit me up on Instagram if you want one of those. And I gotta say, shout out to our contest winners, David Can, Lynn Stewart, my man Alex from Barbosa's Barbecue right here in Denver. You gotta check them out. Really, really great stuff. And my man Andrew Ferrone, thank you all for your great reviews. Inside the Musician's Brain is also brought to you by Americana Vibes. That's the infamous String Dusters record label. We got a lot of good stuff cooking over there. And let's not forget Osiris Media. Big thanks to RJ, to Matt for the mastering, to Mark for the graphics, everyone over there. They've been with me since the beginning. And I also want to just say real quick, I'm part of a really cool fundraiser through CanDaid. CanDaid is an amazing national nonprofit that helps communities with everything from environmental issues to music and the arts. And they've got this cool thing going on called Fishing with a Musician. You can bid on a day of fishing with a bunch of great musicians, myself included, and all that money goes to Candaid, and Candaid does great things. So make sure you check that out. So this is, like I said, the last episode in season four. Another season is in the books, and I just can't thank you all enough for the amazing support, for all the spins, for all the feedback. It truly is 100% what allows me to keep this train rolling. And I have to say, I'm loving making this podcast as much as I ever have. It's a ton of work, but everything that goes into it is challenging and informative. And some of the conversations this season have been incredibly inspirational to me, eye-opening, really, personally. And I've also heard from people who have said that specific things from specific episodes have really made a difference for them, and that's kind of what it's all about. So I'd love to hear that. Huge thanks also to the guests this season. I think I've heard back from more listeners about episode 33 with my man Chris Wood from the Wood Brothers more than any other. Definitely give that a spin if you haven't already. There are things that Chris shares, just his experiences, his different insights, but even more than that, his understanding of his own path through these different challenges and experiences. And ultimately, he just has a very articulate breakdown of some of the very common challenges that confront us all, and some great advice and some great nuggets about how to move through that kind of thing. And I have to say, today's interview with Daniel Donato is right up there in terms of these sorts of discussions, which I love to get into, discussions about just kind of what's underneath it all, about presence, about understanding ourselves, about the journey, about all these important things. And all these conversations are great. There were so many. They were all cool this season. Lindsay Liu was so great in those areas. Of course, Mike Gordon was just about as heady as could possibly be. What more could you want? And like I said, this conversation with Daniel today that you're about to hear is right up there. Yeah, really, really cool guy, really willing to dig in, and clearly has thought about a lot of different aspects of his journey very deeply. And I love that. And one of the things that we get into in this talk, a theme that comes up here regularly on ITMB, and a great concept to kind of bump to the top of our awareness of our attention, and that is just how important, just how powerful our own imaginations are. And the context here with Daniel, you're going to hear him in a minute talking about how imagining his future and actually spending time immersed in that space helps him basically understand himself better and what those dreams are made of, and then subsequently helps him execute that vision. And I just love that. And we talk about it also in more of a momentary sense about how your imagination can kind of almost give you like a self-attitude adjustment. And ultimately, it's just really a gateway to our true self, like I said, to understanding yourself and to the powers that we all possess, powers that most of us just forget to use or forget that we can use them. We think that, whatever, that we're different than the people we look up to, but we're not. We just got to get that imagination going, get that self-exploration, self-understanding going. And from there, it's so true that doors open and really anything becomes possible. So this is your reminder, I guess, to tune in and listen, because the answers really are all out there. And the only thing that ever holds us back is our own concept of our limitations, not actual limitations, but rather our perception of them, because the limitation part, see, that doesn't really exist. So let that sink in for a second. Really, it's good stuff, and it was so fun to hear Daniel's perspective on it all. So let's jump ahead now to my interview with Daniel Donato. I should say his album does not drop until November 10th. So you won't hear as many musical examples in this interview since most of the songs are still unreleased. So let's cruise into this interview with a good chunk of one of the tracks from the upcoming Daniel Donato record, Reflector. This one's called High Country. Here we go.
Well, I got my wheels
Okay, we're here on Inside the Musician's Brain, and my guest today is an unbelievable guitar player, singer, songwriter with a killer new record on the way. Very hot up-and-coming artist Daniel Donato. Welcome to the podcast, man.
Hey, Chris. Thank you for the kind words, and thank you for the notion of having me here today on your podcast. I've been listening to it, I think, maybe 2 years now.
Well, I'd love to hear that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'll go away from it every now and then once you start stockpiling episodes up, and then when we have one of those, you know, 13-hour drive days, I always turn a few episodes on.
Well, I love to hear that, and I'm so glad to get you here on the pod because, man, I'm a fan, and I've loved checking your stuff out. Obviously, you played right before us at Blue Ox this summer, so I got to see the set. And I've been watching some stuff on YouTube, but I've also been listening to Reflector, which is coming November 10th. There's a couple singles already out on Spotify, and this is a tremendous record, man. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. That means a lot coming from you.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot to it, and I think people are just getting to know you as an artist, a lot of people, because you know, you do have a few records out there, but I feel like this new one is a coming out party with the way that your career has evolved and COVID kind of coming on the heels of you stepping out as an artist. Well, now it's like, it feels like this is the moment and this is the album. And it's an exciting time, man. So congratulations. And I want to learn a little bit more about this record from you because it's interesting. As I was listening and checking everything out, this album really brings together this awesome and unique fusion of sounds and sort of your musical concept, but it's bigger than a concept record. It's more like a concept that kind of guides your whole sound, your ethos, your shows, and that's this whole cosmic country thing. And I wanted you to just take us inside that, man. Where did that term come from? And, you know, how did your journey get rolling and unfold as a musician to kind of get you to where you're at now?
Man, there's a lot going on. There's probably years of experiential information that goes into those answers. I think Cosmic Country kind of was born, at least the way that I arrived at it in my life was through my imagination. I first discovered country music when I was 14 at Robert's Western World with the Don Kelly Band. And that was a 4-piece honky tonk band that played live, and they improvised and they served songs. Everybody in the band sang, and everybody brought 25% of the sound to the experience. And it was an upright bass, it was a twangy reverb Telecaster through a Fender amp, and it was 3 chords in the truth. And that really just sparked a part of my personality in motion for me. And then I after discovering that band, I played with that band eventually after going to see them every week for 3 years. And then I ended up getting a lot of work in Nashville as a session guitarist and a hired gun in people's bands. And I was also writing songs for publishing houses and stuff. And I went through this period of my life where I kind of felt like I didn't belong in the city because my natural fruits of my imagination aren't exactly like popular lifestyle country pieces. But I loved country music. I love 50s, 40s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s country immensely. And so when it came time in the trip of my life to go out and start building outside of Nashville on the stage, I was asking myself, well, what kind of country does Daniel do if he doesn't do radio popular country? And the answer came through cosmic country. I was like, well, that's how I view things. And then as I've been doing that now for 5 years, I kind of see that concept is it's a whole approach to the trip as an entirety.
Yeah.
And Reflector is definitely a fruit from that.
Yeah, it really comes through because I hear the elements of you know, the elements of the sound. Like, to me, when I think of the cosmic country thing, it's like the best tonal elements and grooves from country music. You know, like a lot of the really classic things that you love about that good country, and mm-hmm. and also the tele vocab, which is so huge. And all of that is taken and sort of recontextualized in this more experimental psychedelic setting. And you hear some of that on your earlier records. You know, there's moments where you guys stretch out and you mm-hmm. take on, like I said, the more sort of experimental side of things. Mm-hmm. But on Reflector, I feel like it all really comes together from a vision standpoint, you know. And it's like I hear this almost sort of cruising kind of like California sound, you know. And then all these things come together, but it's such a vision well executed. And for those of you who don't know, Daniel's referencing Robert's Western World, which is like, you know, Nashville is such a different thing now. And I moved there in 2004 when it was sort of a heyday, you know, it was kind of relatively undiscovered. But if you wanted to hear good music, you went down to these bars on Broadway and heard unbelievable musicians, you know, cut from many different cloths. But this is like kind of a big deal, you know, and when you see that thrown into your bio, it's like, I don't want people to take that lightly. Like, that's a real proving ground of country music.
I don't either, because Roberts really is when you think of what Nashville was, Roberts is a time and space article of that spirit.
Yes.
It is that place. And I mean, that's Roberts is where Willie Nelson bought Trigger, in that room, in that building.
Yeah.
So, and that is where the first inceptions of the pedal steel guitar were also invented, because it used to be the Showbud Pedal Steel Guitar Factory, which is where Willie bought Trigger. And now it's kind of the last place on Broadway, in more or less Nashville, given the tenure that Roberts has, just as a whole, it's kind of the last place that has remained unchanged and untouched by the commercial offerings of the growth of the city on a cultural level.
I haven't been there in a while, so you're saying it's maintained a lot of the mystique. Okay, awesome. I love to hear that, because the city has changed immeasurably.
A Budweiser is still $3.
A good measure of where it's at.
The city has changed. And I started going down on Broadway when I was in 2009, and I started busking on the street there. And then, you know, I was gigging down there for, you know, 6 years. And by the time I got out of there as a full-time occupant, as a performer down there, it was a completely different trip than what it was when it started. Just like literally completely.
Yeah.
All of the buildings are now three-story concert venues that start at 10 a.m. and end at 3 a.m. and they go all day. And it's just different now. But Roberts isn't. And I kind of had this endowment of a chance to get in there. And that was the start of my discovery of music and my personality and imagination with music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's so cool. And it's a great testament to the fact that, and a theme that you hear a lot here on Inside the Musician's Brain, you know, it's that 10,000 hours thing. You're down there, you play like close to 500 shows before you even step out to do your thing. And that is a musical education for the ages. You know, the songs, the vibe, the musicians that you're able to play with, you know, so you got all that going on. So where does the experimental kind of psychedelic, more Jerry Garcia influence side of things come from?
In just being turned on to that whole trip conceptually, that happened when I was 18 years old, and my U.S. history teacher gave me his entire bootleg collection of Grateful Dead tapes and Grateful Dead universe related recordings. So it was like three binders full of CDs. It was over 200 CDs. And I used to live about an hour south of Nashville. And then on the days that I would be driving into town after school to go play gigs, I would just turn on those CDs. And I started getting turned on to the idea that you could stretch songs in a way that was meaningful and not really like masturbatorial, but in a way that was actually storytelling outside of the vehicle of words, but through the vehicle of frequency and intention, with notes. And that I was just always turned on to. I mean, from the second that I heard Pembroke Pines' Dick's Picks, I was turned on to it. I just knew that that was something that I found a home in. And what was interesting about the Grateful Dead's catalog is they were already, when I discovered them, they had on their live recordings, you know, Johnny Cash songs and Merle Haggard songs and Marty Robbins songs on their electric stuff. And then on their bluegrass acoustic songs they were doing gospel songs that I was familiar with, and they were doing Charlie Munro songs that I was already familiar with just through my service down at Roberts and working there and learning all the music that was necessary to be able to play in that place. So I was already turned on to all those things, and I was getting to hear a band take those songs and stretch them out and bring new life to them. So that always struck me. It was like, how do you take a country song that's 2 minutes and 30 seconds and make it 7 minutes and 20 seconds? And why is it just as interesting? You know, there's something that I was seeking there, and it was leading me towards that band. And then I would say the whole, any psychedelic influence that I had ever experienced started after I was fired from Roberts, and I was, I found myself going out on the road and touring with bands. Okay. And that's when that experience multiple times ended up coming into my life. And just like anything that's real, there's both good and bad things about that.
You know? Okay, what do you mean by that?
Although, you know, the psychedelic experience, like I don't really subscribe to the idea that it turns everybody on.
Okay.
To the enduring spiritual realities of what the universe has to offer. You know, now that I've been, now that I'm a little bit older, I've met a lot of, you know, I meet a lot of people, that, are musicians or aren't musicians that are at shows. And, you know, I meet a lot of people that take psychedelics that are still missing the point, I think. So I don't think it's the thing that turns everybody on and, or, you know, but if you do have the, on a Myers-Briggs level, you do have the personality type where you're excitable and you're open-minded and you're creative and you're a seeking person, then it might be a good vehicle for you. But now at my, I don't give it as much divine equity as I did when I was 21.
Interesting. 22. Yeah. In some circles, it's viewed as a doorway to something.
But it is.
The reality is that there are many, many versions of that. And in that one world, it's heralded as this unique thing that does a thing that maybe only it can do. And I think what I hear you saying is that a lot of people use it for a distraction. But there are so many ways, even just breathing or trying to be present in a given moment, that can kick open that same door that psychedelics or, like I say, many other things can do, that give you a glimpse into something that's deeper than what we just see before us.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, you know, inside the musician's brain, you know, inside any temporal being that is an evolutionary creature of space and time, indwelling within the brain is the supreme. The psychedelics can be a external vehicle that can be used to take your conscious attention and apply reverence to the supreme. But it doesn't work that way for everybody. And I find that to be a really positive piece of data that I've been able to collect in my time. Because I was kind of confused for a second, where it was like, well, what about the people that don't take psychedelics? How do they arrive at these beautiful creations of art? You know, like Kandinsky wasn't taking psychedelics, and, you know, his art is immensely beautiful and in between here and there. You know what I'm saying? In between sure. In the material and the spiritual realms. You know, I think it's really what's inside our brains that deserves a lot of the credit. And for a certain kind of a person, the psychedelics can do it. And trust me, they have helped me in a great way, but it's not really anything that I apply a lot of reverence to. I do think, you know, they probably should be legal. So I like them that much, you know.
What do you feel like you focus your attention and awareness on? Like, for example, in your practice, you know, or in your approach to performance, what do you focus on these days that you feel like helps deliver you to that heightened awareness of, you know, whether it's being really present in the moment, being connected to everything? What do you feel like is getting you there these days?
Well, I feel like in my head, and I see this in a lot of other people's, I see this in everybody I meet, if I'm being honest. I feel like there's almost like a phone in my head that is like a thought adjuster of some kind.
Okay.
And it is a vehicle that allows you to translate what the other party on the phone is saying. And I feel like what the party on the other side of the phone wants me to do is to try to seek the truth and to play with the truth. That is kind of my mantra these days, is that when I'm not playing with the truth on stage, I'm seeking the truth off stage. And that's kind of the trip there. And I feel, you know, truth, beauty, and goodness are the main ideals that I'm always trying to grow with and bring into reality. And, I use my faith and I use grace and I use my imagination and my persistence of my work ethic to try to render those things into space and time, because those ideals are enduring and are spiritually eternal, and they inform these fleeting shadows of material reality. And I think that's a pretty obvious thing, at least to me. So that's kind of what pushes me now, is I kind of feel like I have this thought adjuster that I can almost like evolve and grow with in this like personality ascension, which I feel like what life ultimately is. Because, you know, when you die, they can study now, like Andrew Huberman talks about, like when you die on the physical side of things, like from the start of your life to the end of your life, on all physical fronts, everything starts to go downhill because you eventually die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your blood, your oxygen levels, all that stuff. You know, chemicals, everything, it goes down, but the personality never stops growing. So it never stops changing, and it never stops ascending. It never stops becoming more actualized. So that tells me that the personality is a vehicle that has a eternal destiny of some kind. And so I'm using my personality to try to bring in those, through the vehicle of music, I'm trying to bring in those values into time. Yeah.
Okay, that was, there's a lot there.
There's a lot there.
Yeah,
there's a lot. Yeah,
but
that's the, yeah.
I love this. This is great. But I want to try to just understand this idea of the translator, because there's something very cool there. And I think it points to the fact that if you pay really close attention to what's around you, it's all out there. It's all around you, and we're a part of it.
But, oh, yeah.
But so much of what we experience in life and the Matrix just sort of covers that up from like such an early age. And then you have to somehow hone this, like what I think you're referring to as the translator, to understand and connect with and sort of see the outside world. Is it something like that?
I feel like it's there, it's installed. And I feel like it's infused upon energy, where bodies are electrochemical beings that have beginnings and ends. But when you are born, you have a personality that nobody else has ever had, that will create a reality and a life that nobody else has ever lived or will ever live. And so I can't help but think of it as this kind of weird duality, where if everybody is subjectively different, and we arrive at these transpersonal truths, such as the, you know, the golden rules, etc., then there must be an objectively correct cosmic source in which that we have a connection to. Whether you think you have a responsibility to that source is up to you. Whether you think you should have reverence for that source is up to you. How you want to integrate the frequencies and directions from that source or interpret them is entirely up to you, because you have free will to create your space and time life in whatever manner you see fit. And the way that you ever see anything fit to your life is through the specific subjective disposition of your personality. And so that to me is what the adjuster is doing for me. It's kind of giving me direction from the objective on how to most specifically actualize my subjective experience.
Okay, I'm with you. And how does that square with kind of the self idea? And I know, because I hear about this from a lot of musicians, and I know I've experienced some of it. It's almost like you do have to work at kind of transcending this self thing and this me, this I. But how does that square with what you're referring to as your personality? I'm curious what you think about that.
So are you referring to the self in like a Jungian sense?
In just in terms of, like, you know, a basic idea of, you know, your ego and your feelings of self-preservation and...
Okay, so more like a primitive religion sense of like, I don't want to die.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah,
what's
sure.
my ego? Like that kind of stuff. Like,
yeah. And then you form this image of yourself and then ultimately, I think, like you say, people who are seekers and who ask a lot of these questions, we go through life and we try and put these things together in a meaningful way, because, you know, you do have a life here, and we are going to get off this interview, and I do have to go to the store later and all these sorts of things.
Right. Yeah.
But there's also a much, much deeper, more powerful thing at play that is also here inside of me in some way. But I'm just curious. I hear you using the idea of a personality, and I think that's interesting, and I'm just sort of wondering, you know, where that fits in to you.
Where does personality fit into, or like, how do I work with the self and the ego in regards to these concepts?
Yeah. And just what is that personality? Is that, you know, because you refer to it as something that's uniquely you. And I love that. And I believe in that. We are something, you know, but it can be hard to understand those concepts together.
I became really interested in personality about 3 years ago. And, cause I was seeing during the initial stages of COVID-19 on a medical level, and then also on a sociological, theological level. I was seeing that everybody kind of had their own take on what was this objective thing. Everybody had a subjective opinion based on an objective idea, you know, and whether it was good, bad, or in the middle, which makes it real, I noticed everybody was looking at this thing in their own way. And so I started diving into personality a little bit more, and I did some personality tests, and I had my family take a personality test, and we were all different people, you know?
Yeah.
My specific personality led me to music, and I'm really grateful for that, because it worked out. It works out and worked out and is working out in a way that is very harmonious for me. It's very good. Like, music's a perfect thing for me. And it was something that I think I'd always been seeking until it found me. And then, you know, I was just locked in forever. You know, I remember the first time I played on stage when I was 14, I got off, and I just knew on a level that transcended linear logic that was what I was to do. That was the business that was set forth for me to go and do the bidding for my life. And, you know, I feel proud of that. So, you know, I find that when it comes to the ego, I think that's kind of part of this duality that we have here. Like, it seems like, you know, in the Kabbalion, the principle of correspondence, you know, as above, so below. In order for anything to exist in this evolutionary realm of space and time, there needs to be a duality That's like part of the tax for it to exist in a real way here, is there needs to be a duality to it. And so, you know, the ego is kind of representative to me of like the changing state-based thing that we are. And my personality was kind of just always there. And the way that the personality interacts with the ego creates all these states of anger, states of happiness, exorbitance, depression, anxiety, dreamlike charisma, improvisational persistence and seekingness, all of these things.
Well, I think I'm with you. I'm hearing it. It's almost like you're describing it more akin to like your true nature, like something that's always been there. It's there and it gets covered up, whereas like the ego is always sort of like tagging along with you and evolving, and you're learning how to like work with it, but it's not what you essentially are.
No. And that's why I really love the idea of render unto Caesar's that which is Caesar's, and render unto God's that which is God's, you know, because the Caesar essentially is a metaphor for the temporal and the God is a metaphor for the eternal. And, you know, nobody knows what that word means. Everybody has an idea on what that word means. As far as I know, and what I feel God is perhaps it's a word symbol that designates all personification of deity. And deity is also approximating something that which is divine. And so when I look in my mother's eyes and I feel the oxytocin dopaminergic reaction of love and eternal service, that feels divine to me. And when I look out into a crowd and I bend from the 15th fret to the 17th fret on the B string and the lights go off and everybody goes, whoa, that feels divine to me. And when I look out the window in the morning and I see the leaves falling onto the ground, I, as a human, using my meaning-based seeking mind, find poetic nature in that. And then all of a sudden the sound of silence starts playing in my head. And that feels divine to me. So the personification of all things divine is kind of happening, and I'm witnessing it at all times. So I don't really know where God begins or ends, which tells me that it's something eternal, getting back to the render unto gods that which is God's and that which is unto Caesar's. So I kind of keep the Caesar-God duality thing alive in my mind all the time. And so with the ego, you know, as a touring musician, you know, you have to satiate the temporal in a real way. Like, you can't get fucked up every night and be on a 7-night run, you know, with 6 shows. Cause, you know, otherwise the temporal vessel that you're using to like kind of bring in these like eternal frequencies into the world, you're going to screw that thing up and it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So you got to render properly, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
I love that. We'll get right back to my interview with Daniel Donato after this quick break.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
So tell me, what's challenging for you about this trip when it comes to the music? I mean, whether it's specifically musical things or if it's things that music opens a door for you to see, like what are some of the challenges of this trip that you feel like you've really had to focus on in recent years?
That's a great question, brother. I think, you know, on a societal level, I noticed that on a large scale, the appreciative nature of musicians is oftentimes asymmetrical and pretty reactionary. Pareto's curve. Do you know like Pareto's curve?
Tell me about that.
If you have 100% of a populace, 10% of that populace yields 90% for the whole populace.
Okay.
And then 90% of the creators of that populace share 10% of the success or the fruits or whatever it is. So 10% gets to keep 90 of it, and then 90% gets to share 10 of it. So that's something that I feel like, given just like the structure of our society and how attention span and commerce and all that works, is like you can kind of see that there's like 10% of people that are in our world that have like 90% of the success, you know, which I like. I think there needs to be a free market of some kind. You can't have equal outcome for everybody. I don't believe that at all. I think you need equal opportunity, but definitely not equal outcome, especially with music. I mean, especially with music. So I find that to just be a frustrating reality that I encounter often, you know, things like that. And I also have a hard time organizing all of my thoughts given our touring schedule. We're still in a Sprinter and we're driving during the day. And, you know, it's just a lot on the body and it's a lot on the mind. So I would say the lifestyle of where we're at is not easy.
So what do you do to manage that? What do you do to keep yourself in good form so that, like you say, you know, the temporal vessel can do its job and you're able to, you know, tune into this higher frequency? What do you do to take care of yourself when you're on the road?
I do supplementary practice, you know, like I drink a lot of water. I try not to eat too much during the day, otherwise I'll get too tired and things like that. And that's all vessel-based practice. But I find the thing that works best for me is whenever I can, I take time to just dwell in my imagination. And so when I say that, I wish I could hear everybody's reaction who's listening to what that means to them and what they think about that and if they find that to be a use of time. But I think if you actually go through your back pages, you'll start to see that a lot of the things that you're doing in your life, I'll just speak to myself, a lot of the things I'm doing in my life now, I once imagined in a conscious state or an unconscious state. But the visualization of it came to me at one point in my mind. And then there was like a space and time delivery service that brought it to me 5 to 10 years later. So I just take time to dwell in my imagination. There will be times where I'm really frustrated when we're in traffic or we're going over like some shitty unpaved road somewhere. And I'll just pretend we're in a bus. I'll close my eyes and I'll lay down and I'll just pretend we're in a bus, you know?
Yeah.
And I also try to write songs every day. I like what Trey does. I kind of like that New Jersey work ethic that Trey has. I always related to that because my parents are from New Jersey. And when we moved to Spring Hill, Tennessee, I noticed that my household was very different than everybody else's household that was native to Tennessee. And, you know, there's this kind of New Jersey thing that is just like get up and go and grind and show up for it as much as you can. And so, you know, even if we get 4 hours of sleep at the hotel, I try to wake up at the same time every day and at least have some sort of a regimen, because that's just what my personality likes. You know, I have friends that are very, different with their personality that they've been endowed with, where they don't need a regimen or like anything that's like very consistent. But within the duality of chaos and order, for me, I need some sort of a orderly scheduling of time in order to really dive into what is chaotically creative for me.
Okay. Okay.
You know, yeah, I would love to have a bus and us have, you know, like a room on there where we can have like an interface set up and go and kind of have like a paradisal center for creation. But, you know, I'm grateful for everything that's happening. And, you know, I don't look at anything that's challenging as something that's happening to me, but rather something that is a learning experience that I've created that I have an opportunity to learn from.
I love that. That's a great answer. Speaks to the idea that, and it's so true, that every time adversity is upon you, viewed through a different light, it's the best opportunity you could ever have. And, you know, there's a shift there. It takes time to embrace that and a lot of practice to embrace that on like a day-to-day level where the little things don't throw you off. But it's the truest thing ever. And what you just said a moment ago, I love, you know, you're like, I spend time immersed in my imagination, and you're saying, I don't know what, how that sounds to other people, but I'll tell you how it sounds to me. I think,
please,
that's,
brother. Yes.
I think that's such a great practice and a great thing for people to hear who are listening to this podcast, because the magic doesn't just happen. And the idea of practicing going into a space that you want to be in, the idea of visualizing what might be ahead, it's the most powerful tool. And I think oftentimes people get confused and think that it's something that separates them from someone else, when actually it's something very simple that we all have in common, the idea to conjure this space of imagination. And it doesn't have to manifest in some music career or even something that anyone else sees. It's really just a service to what's inside you and ultimately a practice. And that's, I hear back from a lot of listeners on this point, the idea that like, oh, I thought I was just, you know, they're just sort of sitting around waiting for the muse, if you will, you know, and not realizing that it's something that you need to cultivate, you know.
Oh, and, man.
And it's cool to hear you saying that, you know, it's cool to hear you say that, no surprise, that this is a big part of your daily regimen.
Well, I so you can kind of, the way that the narrative at least was when I was going to school and we were being, you know, quote unquote, taught what we were supposed to, quote unquote, know and supposed to learn. There's not a lot of room for imagination, but if you actually go through the back pages and you just do some actually detailed, logical, linear thinking, everything that has ever been in terms of a creation, whether tangible, like a Snuggie, like an as seen on TV product, or a musical recording like Doggone Cowboy by Marty Robbins, all of that is born from the imagination. And we don't know what the word imagination is, you know, but you use imagination for absolutely everything you do. And you're imagining things all the time. Mm-hmm. So it just, to me, it's a matter of having a relationship with that. And that's where that thought adjuster thing starts to really help. You know, like I'll even, when we were in Colorado last week and we stayed in this terrible cheap hotel and there was all this construction that happened at 7 a.m. Right outside my door. Before I even opened my eyes, my imagination was like, what would the feeling be like if I knew that we played Red Rocks last night and we were also playing it today and I was waking up in my hotel room? How would I be feeling right now? How would that feel?
And how did that
go? What time would sound check be? Well, it certainly didn't stop any of the construction workers. I'll tell you that very well. But to me, it did do something for this Caesar level of myself, to where I was able to kind of have a bit more of a positive and connected approach to what I was doing with my body. You know what I'm saying? So I'm kind of using it. I'm using it all the time, man. I'm just trying to listen to what is telling, really.
Sure. Because we can't control what happens, but we can control how we react to it. Or at least we can work with how we react to it. And we can create a lot of that so-called reality ourselves, you know, with some intention. And like you say, imagination. And I feel that, you know, I think the more, it's just like anything, the more time that you can spend immersed in that zone, the more practice that you have accessing that part of yourself, the more you can conjure it up at the times when you really need it.
You've used your imagination to conjure the life that you have now, I would say, right?
Of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I mean, especially you and your band, when we were able to, you know, I watched you guys at Blue Ox and it was just like, wow. It's like, that's how you do it.
Man, we got to get you up there to jam on something with us the next time we're all in one place. Actually, I got to ask. So, Sugar Leg on the new record, that's Sugarfoot Rag, right? Or a sort of reinterpretation of Sugarfoot Rag in some way.
Yeah. I love Hank Garland. and and Red Foley. You know, I love that old time country and western swing music that was kind of jazz influenced, and it's more or less Sugarfoot Rag. We ended up, after we played it so many times on stage, we ended up having our own tempo and our own chord progression, and our own arrangement of it, and the melody had changed. So, and then Sugar Leg, the nickname, ended up happening and coming into fruition just hilariously. And then, you know, I try to just like, you know, the Bible is a comedy and a drama. And the definition of what a comedy is on some level is that it ends well. And, you know, the idea of the gospel is that there's good news to be had there. So it's ending well. And so I think anything that truly follows that kind of Joseph Campbell hero's journey of something that is dark, light, and so on, there needs to be some comedy in there. There needs to be something that's funny. And so that's kind of where the Sugar Leg thing came into my imagination. Was like, well, how do we have a song that is deadly serious on a musical level, but is also just kind of funny in terms of its title and its story?
Well, I love that track. And I have to say, this is so great. And these are the things that I think people love to hear about. And ultimately, this type of conversation, which is absolutely about Reflector in every way, maybe not in a specific sense, but and all the concepts and energy that went into it. But I gotta say, man, this record just, oh, it's so good. And the singles that are out right now, I love High Country. I love the sound of the record, and you know, and just the energy of it, like I was saying before, you actually summed up the cosmic country thing really well. Tie-dye and plaid, you know, it's like this, and duality, and I keep hearing you say that, and it's so true. You really, it's hard to grasp sometimes, but you can't have one without the other. There is no up without down. And I hear an amazing consistency, but also these songs juxtaposed with each other. Just beautiful work, man. I love the singles that are out. Lose Your Mind is great, but killer tracks, Double Exposure. I've listened to that one a bunch of times. And then I guess last track, Dance in the Desert Part 2. I mean,
oh, yeah.
This stuff is awesome, man. It's equal parts beautiful, and then at times like totally ferocious, but it's a great record, man. I can't tell you enough how much I'm digging it.
Thank you. That really means a lot from coming from you, Chris, because you have a lot of experience with making records and making records in the studio and then setting up for records to eventually happen by playing new songs on stage, and being honest and critical about what can be and what will be.
Yeah, I'm excited to see where the cosmic country journey rolls onto. And I got to ask too, like, what's your impression of kind of what's going on with country music now, and sort of where, you know, where on the Venn diagram you fit in, and where you've been playing these last couple years? You know, what scene or what sort of area do you feel like you're falling into?
I think we're falling into that same scene that is like, just truthful, beautiful, good music that,
amen.
Yeah, you know, it's like when you say the word country music, I definitely don't like live a country lifestyle, like in terms of like what country lifestyle music is on the radio in Nashville, or like what the big like hot country playlists are putting on Spotify, you know, I don't have like a, I don't work a job in like a small town, and I don't drive a big truck, and like, I just don't like the lyrics. A lot of like what is commercially driven within country music is like story-based lyric stuff. And the lyrics of what, like, you know, Luke Bryan or Jason Aldean and Luke Combs or stuff like that, you know, every now and then I'll turn that stuff on and listen to it, but really not really, because I don't identify with the story of that trip in my life so much. But there's this era of country music where I really do, where it's like Merle Haggard and Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson and Buck Owens, where it was about the story of your life and going somewhere, and then also the adventure of your life and the adventure of love and the adventure of happiness and all that. And I remember when Sturgill Simpson put out Metamodern Sounds in Country Music. It was the same year that Jason Isbell put out Southeastern. That was like 2000, I think it was like, well, I don't even know, maybe 2014, 2013, I think
something
it was.
Something like that.
That's when things started changing. That's when everything started changing. And then, so it seemed like what happened was there was like old-timey sounding music that lyrically people could relate to and find parts of their life in their personality in, but it wasn't necessarily popular commercial country music, but it still sounded like old-timey country music. And so we have that going for us on some level, and then we also have this thing going for us with the resurgence and revival of what's going on with the improvisational music scene. You know, like Goose and Billy Strings are probably the most notable personality groups that are alive in the scene right now that have that are really doing a big thing with scale of where they're playing and their community. And so I see us fitting somewhere between those two realms.
Yeah.
You know, but really at the end of the day, any band, any artist, any collective of music is really just its own frequency. It's its own TV channel that you can tune into and dig. And there's enough room for everybody. It's a feast, not a famine.
I couldn't agree more. I love that. And yeah. I know for me, I just love to hear the elements of country music that I love in the hands of someone like you, reinterpreting, reimagining. And I think, you know, you get extra props because it has such a convincing live component too. I mean, a lot of this stuff is great music, but then it comes onto the stage and it essentially is very similar to what's on the record. And there's no knock on that. I mean, that's what some performers do. That's, like you say, it's just a different channel. It's just their concept of what they want to do. And I think a lot of fans tune into that in a great way. But then your show has this experimental and very cool kind of like every night is different. Come on this journey with us element that I think really, really brings a lot of people in and demands a whole other set of skills that you hone over a lot of time.
That was what was so great about Roberts is I was kind of being led to already have the endurance and mindset of how to do a 3 to 4 hour show.
How do you do a 3 or 4 hour show? I mean, that's, I know.
I have no idea. I have to think it's some sort of a spiritual force, you know.
And what about now? Tell us, this is always a fun area to hit. How does it look for you now getting ready for a show? Like in the last hour before a show, what are you doing to kind of get in the zone and get ready to, like I say, get on stage and go on a journey with the crowd?
Well, you know, from the second I get to the venue, when my guitar comes out of the bag, it doesn't leave my neck. I don't put it down unless I'm going to the restroom or I'm eating something from catering. It doesn't leave. I'm playing the guitar. For however many hours I play on stage at night, I want to have a guitar with my hands on it for at least that much time. So I kind of have this as above, so below equality of time investment, because there's this weird thing that happens that when you go to be vulnerable and truth reaching within your personality, and you do that in front of a lot of people, that can be quite an experience that is overwhelming consistently, no matter how many times you do it and you have the myelin sheath wrapped around your nervous system with your fingers and you're good at doing something on a technical level. There's something going on there. So I want to have as much time with myself with the instrument before I take myself and the instrument and put it in front of everybody. So I'm kind of playing, if we play for 3 hours that day, I'm going to play for at least 3 hours prior to the time I hit that stage. Okay. And if we're playing for 90 minutes that day or 75, I'm doing that for 75 or 90. But we just finished festival season, so we're getting back into the 3 hour show thing. And then the band and I, we go through the set list, actually. I got this idea from Billy when he came in. I think we were doing an after show for him in Cleveland, or was it Vermont? And he and I were talking, and he was saying that an hour before they go on, they spend 45 minutes in one of their green rooms just going through the set and kind of socializing and I guess going through their imagination on a collective level of what the trip is going to be. So I like to do that with my band. We'll sing songs together. We'll get up in a triangle and look each other in the eyes and sing harmonies, you know.
And then in terms of the instrument, are you doing certain exercises that get you in the zone, or are you just like, okay, or are you also, there's got to also be some component of like, I'm just connecting to the source here and feeling that, and things to get your fingers warmed up, and then things to get your kind of like spiritual side warmed up.
Yeah, the spiritual side, we do Wim Hof breathing.
Okay.
We do 12 minutes of Wim Hof as often as we can before a show, depending on the green rooms. Again, we're still at this weird stage where some green rooms are glorified janitor's closets.
Yes.
So it's hard to, we're seven people that are on the train with us. So we sometimes don't have room to do that. But I would say 90% of the time we end up getting a Wim Hof in. That really helps.
Yeah.
To really just connect with your body and regulate the breathing of what's going on there. That's really good. And then when it comes to the instrument stuff, I have non-creative regimented practices that I've always done since I was 14. And then I have things that I'm learning that I've never done before that I'm always working on. And so I kind of just spend time throughout the day going through those things.
Okay.
You know,
okay,
and that cool. Stuff's always changing. You know, yeah. It's just a lot of right hand stuff, like, whatever it can be. Like right now I'm working on like these harmonics, like these Lenny Bro, Chet Atkins, like Steve Kimmock showed me that when I was in Jackson Hole recently. And
I should say, by the way, Daniel has had the guitar in hand for this entire interview. For those of you who are listening, in use or not, it is clearly part of this man's, an extension of this man's body and psyche. And that comes through in the music, brother. I'm telling you, man.
Thank you.
This new record is awesome, and it's out November 10th. There's two singles out now, and I took a glance at your tour schedule, and my man, it is full on through the end of the year.
Yeah,
so
that's good.
No matter where you are, you should take a look at Daniel Donato's schedule. Tune in, and I assure you that when Reflector drops on November 10th, you're going to want to check it out. And a huge thanks to you for joining me on the pod today, man. I really appreciate it. This has been so awesome.
Oh, man, it's just been an absolute honor. I can't wait to do it again sometime. You got to come on my podcast sometime, too.
Oh, come on. Please.
Yeah.
Let's do it. I'll take you up on that. And I'm going to keep an eye on your schedule as well. And hopefully we'll cross paths soon.
Yeah, man. Absolutely.
Awesome.
I love
thanks,
that.
Daniel. All right, that's a wrap on episode 40, and that indeed is the end of another season of Inside the Musician's Brain. Season 4 is in the books. Huge thanks to my amazing guest today, Daniel Donato. The guy is a total ripper. You got to check out one of his shows. You got to stay tuned for his new record, Reflector, coming November 10th. Of course, huge thanks to all of you for listening. Leave us a review, blah, blah, blah. You know what to do. But seriously, I really appreciate all the support. That is what keeps me going and keeps me afloat here in the podcast stratosphere. Gonna take a few months off, regroup, chill out a little bit. We got a bunch of string duster stuff going on, and I'm excited to work on some new Trad Plus music, so stay tuned for that. And keep an eye on my website, chrispandolfi.com, for updates and some stuff that I'm going to be writing here in the coming months. Shout out to my sponsors, Deering Banjos and Jono Pandolfi Designs, and to Americana Vibes and Osiris Media for helping me make the podcast happen. And thanks once again to all of you for tuning in. I'll see you right back here in a few months when we go back inside the musician's brain. Osiris.
Hello out there.
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Minahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform. and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.